If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
And so it's important that although the defense now suggests there's something exculpatory about it or something about it that's important, it is important to note that the defense never filed a motion for the production of the Canton Police Department video. It is not incumbent or assumed that the Commonwealth is going to obtain every video from every part of a town during an incident. It's not assumed that they will do that. The Commonwealth seeks evidence that they think is exculpatory. They seek evidence that they think is relevant material, and when they receive it, they are supposed to provide it. There are many cases where video from a police department is never provided to the defendant unless they ask. Or many cases where it may be a video of the booking, but not the hallways, not the bathrooms, not the back parking lot. Put in context that the defense theory was an evolving theory throughout this case to this day. The defense theory was that it was some third party culprit, unidentified, who committed this act that led to the death of John O'Keefe. In fact, if you see earlier interviews, the defense position publicly was, you know exactly who did it, intimating that there was a specific person. Now that recently has changed. If we see the recent interview 2 weeks ago on Fox 25, the quick answer was, we have no idea who did it. We don't have to know. And so this fluid position is not notice to put the Commonwealth on notice. They're supposed to chase down every potential idea or creation that the defense has. It's important to look at the motion that has been presented to your honor on behalf of the defense, where they claim that they moved to preserve video evidence. And when you look at that motion, the best it says is that they moved to compel physical evidence. That does not put the Commonwealth on notice of video evidence at the Canton Police Department.
Was this the Stoughton District Court motion?
It is.
Okay.
And I know the Superior Court did not adopt it. However, I think the Commonwealth being on notice is the point. Even if it's in district court, I think it's the Commonwealth's responsibility.
I agree with that.
Okay. And so, Attorney Iannetti, and I've mentioned this before, was very prolific in his pretrial discovery motions. Very meticulous. And when you look at his meticulousness, if there was a need or a desire for video, he certainly would have asked for it. He didn't. In fact, when you look at the perspective of Attorney Iannetti, you don't have to look much further than his characterizations of how he sees the difference between the crime scene in the Canton Police Department. I've attached, for your honor and for the defense, exhibit number 4, trial testimony of Trooper Nicholas Guarino. And when he cross-examines Nicholas Guarino, he is pretty clear that there is a difference between the Canton Police Department and the crime scene. He cites on page 75, but you'd agree with me, the Canton Police Department wasn't the crime scene, correct? And Trooper Guarino says, I never said crime scene in my report, I wrote scene. And Mr. Attorney Iannetti iterates, okay, well, Canton Police Department was not the scene of any crime, was it? So the defense is hard-pressed now at this moment where they are trying to create prejudice that doesn't exist to try to convert a motion that they filed with very specific intentions for physical evidence to now suggest that that includes Canton Police Department because the Canton Police Department is somehow the crime scene. It doesn't convert. In argument, Attorney Jackson characterizes not only Trooper Proctor's testimony, and I encourage the court to look at that because when you read it in context, I think it clearly screams that Trooper Proctor is hiding nothing whatsoever. But if you look at Trooper Buchanan's testimony, on June 6, 2024, if you start at page 103, Attorney Jackson, to paraphrase, I'm not quoting him verbatim, suggests that there's something about Trooper Buchanan that is lying about his position or about what he saw, or that Trooper Buchanan admittedly saw the inverted video. Not the case. Trooper Buchanan reported that he did not see the inverted video until after Canton produced it, because how would he see it before Canton produced it? And that was in his preparation in May. And he did not say that he sat down with ADA Lally and watched the inverted video. He was asked, were you shown any of the videos that you've seen in anticipation of your testimony? Now remember, there's not just Canton Police Department video at that point. There is video from Ring, Town Hall, a number of different places. And he said, not during the first meeting, I did review video during the second time. Question, okay. And that video that you did see the second time, was that the interior video of the Sallyport that we saw yesterday, correct? He says, Trooper Buchanan, I'm just trying to remember exactly what video I saw. I have reviewed videos outside of our meetings. That is what he put in his report about reviewing in May, not with ADA Lally. So I don't remember exactly what video Mr. Lally showed me. That wasn't the characterization that was provided in argument. This is very different. Question, but you do recall seeing the video that you saw yesterday, the sort of clear one that has the crime scene tape being put up and all that. You've seen that one before. That's the inverted video. Answer, yes. I'm on page 104. And that was with Mr. Lally, correct? Trooper Buchanan, clearly. That is not correct because I do not recall when I saw that video or what video I saw with Mr. Lally. That sworn testimony is not only in stark contrast with the characterization that was offered by the defense, but it directly contradicts the conclusion they ask you to reach, that Trooper Buchanan watched this video with ADA Lally in preparation for trial, therefore it is a lie that the Canton Police Department provided the inverted video sometime earlier. That's sworn testimony. Now, again, trying to assert some type of relevance, the defense suggests there is something in the federal materials that would show relevance because Mr. Higgins said in the federal materials that he does not believe he made any phone calls. If you were to look at that testimony in the federal materials, you would see there was an enormous amount of conversation about the period in which he was sleeping. And there were dialed calls between him and Mr. Albert. And so you have to look at it in context rather than say it's an unequivocal denial and there's an aha moment. There is no aha moment. So,
do you have the grand jury cite? I think I might have got it from Ms. Little earlier, but the grand jury testimony of Brian Higgins. I have it. It's just easier if you have a cite to that.
I have a tab, but I don't have Attorney
McLaughlin. I'm sure Ms. McLaughlin can get it
for me. I'll provide it momentarily.
All right, thank you. Okay.
So what really arises from the subterfuge is that the defense did not ask for video. There was video provided when the prosecutors learned about it. There was video that was in the hands of Trooper Proctor that should have been provided to the prosecutor that wasn't. There was nothing done to alter or taint the video. There was nothing destructive about it. There was no tactical advantage. There was no benefit to the government. And clearly from Trooper Proctor's testimony, there was no effort whatsoever to hide it. It should have been managed better, no doubt. But there was nothing about it that was prejudicial. There was nothing about it that showed tampering or altering. And so ultimately, the import of the defense's argument is that this evidence, this information, is exculpatory. It's exculpatory because what they claim is that it would show that Ms. Reed's taillight was cracked, not missing a piece. Now, first thing we look at is Nick Barros's testimony. And if you have an opportunity to look at his testimony, on page 12, line 1, the defendant told you part of the story. I saw there was some damage to the rear taillight. To my best ability and recollection, that taillight was not completely damaged. It was cracked. But they forgot the next part. And there was a piece missing, but not completely damaged. That's exactly how we see Ms. Reed's car later on, after it is at Canton. The entire taillight is not missing. There is a piece missing. That piece, where the fractures of it are found at 34 Fairview, right near Mr. O'Keefe's body. The same parts of the taillight fragments that are found in the sleeve of his shirt. And so it's not simply cracked. Even the witness they tried to lean on, Mr. Barros, says more. And so if that taillight is not just cracked, if that taillight is missing, then there is nothing exculpatory whatsoever about the Canton video. It's a red herring. Because there can be no plant of fractured taillight if it's already gone before it gets to Canton. There can't be. And so when looking at the evidence, it is unequivocally clear that piece of the taillight is missing well before that car ever gets to Canton. And so we can quibble and we can dispute and we can go back and forth all day, but the best way is to just show you the evidence. And so when we look at the evidence, let's start first with the fact, the claim that the Sallyport videos were tampered with. Canton went back before January 29, 2022, and they took samples of the video to see if it was in the same condition, inverted for the back wall and fuzzy for the front wall. And we have those, and we've turned those over to the defense, and I just want Your Honor to see a small clip of that to show this condition, these conditions, existed before this case was even a moment. So with the court's permission, I'm going to ask to put up exhibit number 2. Exhibit number 2 shows the inverted camera from January 1st, 2022. Now this is 28 days before Ms. Reed's Lexus hits the Sallyport area. Now you can see, if you stop that please, thank you very much, on that wall, on that garage wall, there's a 4, it is backwards. This Sallyport video was not doctored by Trooper Proctor. It wasn't altered by Trooper Buchanan. It was in existence well before Ms. Reed's car showed up to that Sallyport. Similarly, front wall camera, could you please put on exhibit 3? Exhibit 3 is from January 28, 2022, a day before Ms. Reed's vehicle makes it to the Sallyport. And you can see the quality. It wasn't distorted on purpose. It wasn't manipulation by the state police. This is the way the camera worked in Canton. Thank you very much. And so the idea of tampering, we can claim it, we can assert it without fact, but we can prove it did not happen. Now, what we know is that missing taillight was not tampered with because it was gone hours before police even touched Ms. Reed's vehicle. At 5:08 a.m., she left Meadows Road. That's John O'Keefe's home. And when she left at 5:08 a.m., that taillight part was already missing. If we look at Exhibit 6, please. And this is from the Ring video of John O'Keefe's home. This evidence directly contradicts the idea that the Sally Port video is relevant to show any break or planting of evidence. As Ms. Reed nudges into Mr. O'Keefe's car, she will pull forward and will stop the video in two spots so you can get a clear look of that rear taillight missing. Forward, please. Thank you. And then ahead one more. You can see the white light shine. Stop. You can see it clearly missing. You can't plant something that's already gone. And the reason why you see white, it is a red taillight cover, and when the red is missing or gone, as it is in this case, the white bulb still shines, and that's why it shines white. The defense position is also contradicted by the ARCA witnesses. If we look at Dr. Wolf's testimony, day 31 of trial, it's noted as Exhibit 10 in our package, page 36, ADA Lally asks the good doctor, "Now, doctor, in the course of your analysis or review of materials here, were you ever provided with a video of the defendant backing out a garage and making contact with Mr. O'Keefe's vehicle in his driveway at about 5:07 in the morning on January 29th. He says, "I'm not aware of that." And then if we move to page 124, line 1. Now, as far as you're aware from the review and your testing and everything that you did in this case, if a collision occurred at a lower speed, say 1-2, anywhere from 0 to 5 miles an hour, would that create the damage to the taillight that you observed in this particular case? And Dr. Wolf says, at that speed, no. We provided notice of our own expert. And there is one thing, many things, but one critical thing the experts will all agree on. That nudging did not cause the damage to that taillight. The defense position is also contradicted by dash cam footage. Sadly, an officer went to the O'Keefe home to check on his niece and nephew on that tragic day. And when he did, he had a dash cam video further reinforcing that that taillight is missing well before that vehicle makes it to the Sally Port area. If we could play Exhibit 7, which is the dash cam footage showing Mr. O'Keefe's car in his driveway at 8:22 a.m., if you could close up to the court, please. If you compare the right side to the left side, although covered and impacted by snow, if you could close more close up, please, you can see that taillight, just like the detective in Dighton said, just like the 508 Ring video shows, is missing. Is missing. There's no plant. The defense's position is also contradicted by the alarm.com video that we received pursuant to Rule 17. There are two videos, 8 and 9. If we could play Exhibit 8, please. This is the defendant's car arriving in Dighton in the driveway. the defendant on the passenger side, and you can see them walk to the back of the car near the right taillight and stop. And if the question is, what are they stopping for? We can play video 9. And this is when the car is being put on the tow truck before it makes it to Canton. And just like 508 in the driveway of Meadows, John O'Keefe's home, you will see that right taillight shine white, showing the missing taillight cover on 2 occasions. If you have an opportunity to stop the video at the important points, please do so.
Can you lower it?
We cannot.
Can you zoom in on it?
Your Honor, I would encourage the parties to look at it on the computer. The clarity is much better, and it's very clear, the white light missing video. I cannot see it clearly on the screen.
So will you give me a flash drive of all of these exhibits?
Oh, there we go.
Okay.
If you look at it on a small screen, see right there?
I do see it.
Yep. And then you'll see it again. So the alarm.com video contradicts the defendant's position that there is anything exculpatory about these Sallyport videos. In fact, this whole idea of third party or plant doesn't come to town until 9 months after Ms. Reed is indicted. Perhaps the best evidence that contradicts the defense position that there's any relevance to the Sallyport video, that there's any type of plant by anybody, is from the defendant herself. Ms. Reed spoke to Gretchen Voss on June 20th, 2023. And in that testimony, or in that interview, she said, when my car was seized, there was a few small pieces of taillight missing that I had picked out at John's at 5:45 before we drove over to Fairview. I'm showing Jen and Carrie, look what I just did to my light. And I'm worried that there's gonna be some kind of electric short circuit. There's like the bulb is showing and some of the red plastic is missing. So I picked pieces out of the light housing that kind of collapsed within the light and dropped them in John's driveway. And so I say to the court, the production should have been sooner. It should have been cleaner. This should have been a log or an entry. The failure to provide was inadvertent. It was unfortunate. It shouldn't happen. But it's not Brady. It's not exculpatory. It's not intentional. It's not tampered with. It was inadvertent and inconsequential because the evidence is overwhelming that that light is missing before the car makes it to the foot of the Sallyport, so there can be no plan. That is my argument regarding the Rule 14 issue. I would like to have time to speak about the claim of jury tampering. I understand the temperament of the court. I'm not tone deaf, but it is a claim that was lodged that has collateral consequence. And I think it's important for me to be able to address it. May I?
Yes.
The claim of jury tampering is probably one of the most serious claims that one can make, because it's not simply an attack on a case. It questions the fabric of our entire judicial system. If a good juror comes to court and believes there is no integrity in the court or in the judicial system, it is impossible for a fair-minded juror to even consider evidence because they do not trust the system to begin with. And if a government actor or a trooper or a police officer tampered with a jury, that would be one of the biggest, most abhorrent transgressions that could happen. Because of the collateral consequence of tampering with the jury, it would take away the community's belief in our system. On the other hand, if there is a claim of jury tampering, and it's baseless, and there is no evidence. It is not only a direct attack on the judicial system, it would seem to be an effort to try to undermine the authority of the system in court before a trial to impede the ability to have a fair trial. It is an extraordinary claim. And it's notable, the defense motion to dismiss, it's not just a motion to dismiss, it's a motion to dismiss for extraordinary government misconduct. So when you make an extraordinary claim about jury tampering, there should be extraordinary evidence. There isn't even ordinary evidence. There is no evidence of jury tampering in this case. Now, I don't want to belabor this, but it's important because of the consequence of what happens when a claim like this is lodged. There is damage. And why I'd rather sit down, as I said before, a lie unchecked becomes the truth. And so, how does one propagate a claim of jury tampering when there's no evidence? Well, first, you need to plant the seed of corruption. And all you have to do is whisper it and hope the poison goes out there and is resonating in the potential community. And so what happens in this case? The defense finds a willing partner who covets an opportunity to meet with the defendant. They find a time, like after the Super Bowl, so there's this national exposure, and they just seep the information. They just seep it into the public and let it resonate. There can be no retort. The government can't respond. No facts, no evidence. Just saturate the public. Now, it's important to see or hear or read what is said, because this really is the acorn that is being planted that cannot be rebutted. And it's not insignificant that this same information before this interview is being disseminated by Mr. Carney. This idea that there was tampering by Lieutenant Fanning. Not a coincidence. And so during this interview that the defendant and the attorney have, the question's asked, I don't know why it's asked, but it's asked, there have been sort of these unsubstantiated claims in the atmosphere that there might have been some funny business with the jurors who were dismissed. Really? And Mr. Jackson says, right. The question, is this a real concern that you have? Is this something that you are looking at, or have you just dismissed it as a rumor? Answer, I never just dismissed that as rumor. Something like that, it's too convenient for the prosecution for us to just dismiss out of hand. Do I have any evidence, specific evidence that there was jury tampering? I don't have any specific evidence of it. And yet we have a motion filed 2 weeks later. Do I think there are questions that should be asked? Do I think that there are questions that have been raised about the way the jurors were dismissed and who was dismissed very specifically? And then it continues on page 13 of the transcript. Question. One of the state troopers who was involved with the Norfolk DA's office and on the periphery of the investigation was also responsible for the jury? Not sure where these questions come from. Answer, right. He wasn't that far on the periphery of the investigation. He was involved in the investigation. He was direct supervisor over the individuals that were testifying and over and about whom we had leveled some very, very serious claims and ended up proving those claims during the course of direct and cross-examination in the presentation of our case. That person, that supervisor, we found out well in the trial. As a matter of fact, at the end of the trial, we found out is the very person who was governing the jurors. That's a question that should be raised. That is an issue that should be teased out. Should never, ever happen. That is the very definition of a conflict of interest. Question, is that standard in Massachusetts for just the DA's office to assign whoever they want to be sort of, you know, supervisor of the jury? Yeah. Is it standard in Massachusetts? I hope not. Never seen that in my life. But if I had a nickel for every time I said, I've never seen this type in my life as it pertains to the Massachusetts justice system, the criminal justice system, I'd have a lot of nickels.
So, I didn't see that interview. I don't have the transcript. I'd like a copy of that transcript.
Your Honor, I understand. I may be mistaken. We produced all of the exhibits to the court, and you should have a transcript. If not, I will get it to you immediately.
Okay.
Okay. So after step one, finding a vehicle to plant the seed, and they did that very effectively, the next step is they have to identify our target. Who are they going to blame? Who's going to be the villain? In this case, a villain goes from anybody that gets in the way. It could be a soccer mom. It could be a police officer. It could be a good Samaritan. Anybody that crosses the path is a target. And now they decided they were going to identify Lieutenant Fanning. Lieutenant Fanning is one of the most conscientious, dedicated, admired state police officers in Massachusetts. After having his name attempted to be sullied all over social media, attacking his integrity and his name, I can dare say that Lieutenant Fanning is in a different position than many. His integrity is so reputable, none of that will break him or his reputation. But it happened. When you look at the motion filed by the defense in this case, and they found their target in Lieutenant Fanning, you look at this motion, page 15. It's important when they made this public pleading, getting back to my request for your honor the other day. You look at the bottom of page 15. It talks about Lieutenant Fanning and tries to align him or associate him with Trooper Proctor because Trooper Proctor's text message was on a chain that included Lieutenant Fanning. Lieutenant Fanning did not reprimand or otherwise correct his subordinate's disgusting and inappropriate behavior. As a result, he was investigated by the Office of Professional Integrity and Accountability for allegations of inappropriate correspondence between department members. True. But then they leave off the punchline. They put this in a public document. They try to smear him, degrade, demean, dehumanize. But what they leave out is that after this thorough investigation by the Office of Professional Accountability, where they took strong measures, very strong measures when they found something that they were not in agreement with, they concluded that these complaints were not sustained.
So we were all aware of that. I received verification of that through the pleadings. Counsel was all aware of that. I just need the date. When was he cleared? When was that made public?
We'll have to provide that to you.
Was it prior to this? Was it prior to the motion being filed?
Yes, it was last year, last fall. I can provide the date right now.
Okay.
Trooper Lieutenant Fanning is not in a unique position.
If I may, Your Honor, sorry. It was July 17th, 2024.
He is similarly situated to the many first responders and witnesses in this case. And then, without any basis, the defense then distorts that Lieutenant Fanning was in charge of juror security. He had control of the jury, and he had access to the jury. Think about what those statements say to our community, who are going to pile in here in less than a month to try to give a fair trial to both sides. Think about what those words mean. After selecting their target and trying to dehumanize him and degrade him, they then try to create an illusion of this grandiose havoc that is running amok, trying to get the community to think Trooper Fanning controlled, had access, and tampered with the jury. Think about that concept. Not only is it an attack on Lieutenant Fanning, it is an attack on the integrity of the trial court. I've walked a lot of hallways in the trial courts over the past 30 years. In the heartbeat of trial courts is the court officers who take their duty so seriously. They help, they assist, they guide, and they have solemn pledges. They are charged with the responsibility of the jury. To suggest this is to suggest that the hardworking men and women in our trial court system who come here every day for everybody else's benefit, it is to suggest that they would cede their authority to the state police and abscond from their duty and responsibility to protect that jury with no basis whatsoever. That is the concept that they are promoting in this motion. The trial court personnel throughout this state are steadfast and dedicated. I've tried a lot of cases, and I think most of the lawyers in here have. It is without a doubt in Massachusetts that these dutiful men and women of the trial court protect and are sworn at the end of every case and jury instructions to protect the jury. And these trial court employees, especially here in Dedham, some of the finest, would never abscond that duty. And yet it is now in the public domain, this suggestion. The only way that you dispel innuendo, suggestiveness, unsupported claims, and the poison that can seep into the community, the only way you can stop that is with fact. So I'm going to list a few facts for the record. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning was not in charge of juror security. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning did not have control of the jury. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning did not access the jury. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning was part of a multi-agency cooperative effort to ensure the safety of the public and court participants, which required numerous local police officers and state police because of the bedlam that was created outside. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning never, ever, ever met with or interacted with any juror. Fact: at all times, Lieutenant Fanning worked from a remote location, jointly managing operations for the safety of the public, never setting foot on this property when the jury was here, never meeting a juror, never looking at a juror, never being seen by a juror. Fact: no evidence any trial court personnel ever ceded their obligations and duty and handed them off to Lieutenant Fanning. Fact: Lieutenant Fanning heard numerous rumors from various sources about a juror who expressed potential bias. Fact: Trooper Fanning never investigated, approached, or inquired. He heard the information and provided it to the trial court as is responsible, dutiful, and proper. And I'll repeat one more time, Lieutenant Fanning never, ever, ever interacted, controlled, or met with any juror. Your Honor, these claims in the motion to dismiss have a theme. Different issues, same theme, same pattern, same effort. Your Honor should dismiss it outright, and we should move to trial. Thank you.
If I may, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm going to address in reverse order some of the statements made by Mr. Brennan. And I want to talk first about this issue of juror interference, which is what we called it. These words matter. We've claimed that there's interference. He indicates that that would be an abhorrent transgression if there were interference with a juror or a jury. We agree. It would be an abhorrent transgression. The information that we have in front of us is not the information that Mr. Brennan just recited, which is interesting. I'll get to the facts that he very dramatically stated in just a second. Because this is a fact-based inquiry, one that we asked for standing right over there at sidebar and didn't get. But Mr. Brennan, with no support to back it up, and I'm going to ask a couple of pointed questions about that, recites these facts after facts after facts that he claim absolve the Commonwealth of any transgression as it pertains to the jurors. And when I say Commonwealth, I'm talking about the Massachusetts State Police. Very clearly, in a clever, almost too cute by half argument, Mr. Brennan talks about the good court officers populating this courtroom and this courthouse, about whom we have made no allegation, no claim, nothing. We have nothing but the highest respect and regard for the men and women who wear that uniform and perform these duties. None. Zero. And he knows that. But in an effort to create an enemy where there isn't one, he acts like we've insulted the court officers, which we haven't. He also said that Lieutenant Fanning stood up here and gave basically a CV, a resume for him, and said, "It's the greatest guy on the face of the earth." I don't know Lieutenant Fanning. I don't know if he knows Lieutenant Fanning. Not really the point. It's in the personality contest. He said that we identified somebody with an unassailable reputation. We identified him? We didn't identify anybody. We were standing up at sidebar, fat, dumb, and happy, not knowing what was going to happen, when somebody else identified him. It wasn't us. And by the way, everything that we filed concerning this was under seal. We didn't disclose anything in any court document. It wasn't a public document, it was under seal. Mr. Brennan then states that he was also a subject, this person with this unassailed career, was the subject of an IA investigation for his conduct on this case. It's not even about something tangential. It's about his conduct on this case, his supervisory role as it pertains to Michael Proctor and his, and I'll repeat it, disgusting conduct as it relates to my client and his text messages, etc. When he was asked about those text messages, his claim was, "I was on vacation and I didn't read them." And ultimately, the Massachusetts State Police investigation cleared the Massachusetts State Police officer. We've seen that happen before. The question, or questions,
I could,
that surround this inquiry, and the reason that we included it in our motion to dismiss, is because it appears that Ms. Reed did not get a fair trial because of this juror's dismissal. How would the person who's unidentified to this day, unidentified, how would this person know who the juror sitting in one of these seats was, if she was at a private location? I won't mention the location. How would they know? How would they know to identify her? How would they know what she said? How would they know to record her illegally, potentially, if that happened? How would they know these things? How would they know that if she was a juror, that she was a juror on the Commonwealth versus Reed matter specifically? And how would this unidentified person know of all of the authority figures to go to Lieutenant Fanning, of all people, who is then described to us after the fact as the, quote, commander of the extensive security operations that this case has required? And I went through that with the court this morning, but I just want to reiterate it one more time. Of course it makes perfect sense that we would presume that if he's the commander, I don't think it gets much bigger than commander, if he's the commander of all security operations, he's a commander over operations that are attendant to the courts, the actual courts' security, the personnel's security, the party's security, to whatever degree that is necessitated, but maybe most importantly, the juror's security. That is a reasonable next step to conclude, a reasonable inference from the facts that we were given. But we do know this. He was this same Fanning that was just randomly picked to go report this to was also the person that was in Miss Reed's house seizing her phone just months before the trial. He's also the person that was interviewing witnesses or supervising the interviews of witnesses in this trial. He was also the person that was on the text messages between Proctor and his buddies at MSP talking about her and trying to find nudes. We know all of that existed. And yet, we were denied an opportunity, Your Honor, an important opportunity, to simply inquire before this juror was dismissed. That's all we asked. Let's get Lieutenant Fanning in here, let's find out what the source of this is, and let's figure out, is it even remotely true? Remember, the juror never said it was true. But lo and behold, minutes before I stood up to give my summation, that juror's removed. That's the problem. This isn't about court officers and besmirching court officers' reputations. That's not what this is about. This is about what happened at sidebar in the matter of minutes that denied Ms. Reed her constitutional right. There's a couple of other points that I just want to make. Mr. Brennan started his comments by talking about the Sally Port video and how unimportant it is. How unimportant that video is. And I'm not going to go through all my points again. The court doesn't need to hear that. But I do want to make this point. He says it's not important. There was nothing to see here. We don't pull videos normally. Yeah, of course you don't pull Sally Port videos if you're investigating a bar fight. This was the purported murder weapon. This truck is the thing that the Commonwealth suggests was used to kill a cop. You think the video of it being pulled into the Sally Port might be of some evidentiary value? I don't know. Can't imagine why that would be important. Can't imagine why that might have some evidentiary materiality. But I do know this. I do know this much. The one guy who thought it was important, the lead investigator. He pulled it all. All of it. He was super, super convinced it was important. And he's the guy that once pulled it, hid it from us for nearly 3 years. Mr. Brennan spent some time talking about the difference between cracked and missing. Interesting point. Now, I'm not going to go through a bunch of videos and audios. The court has seen all the pictures and photographs that it needs to see, and the court has a very, very good memory. We've never, ever disputed that the light was cracked at 5:07 or so a.m. That's how it got cracked, is the point. It got cracked on that traverse. And a piece was missing. A piece was missing. Not according to me. According to another agency's sergeant, Barros, who said a piece was missing, but it wasn't completely damaged. Recall that when that light was completely reconstructed with the 46, 47 pieces that were purportedly found, well, they were found at or near 34 Fairview, and then they were reconstructed, does the court recall what that reconstruction looked like? That taillight was put together almost in its entirety. Almost, except a piece was still missing. It was a piece unaccounted for. There's a big difference between a crack and the condition of that taillight, which we've now seen, where literally the entire lens material is basically gone. There's a few shards left on some edges, but the entire lens is basically gone. So yeah, it's relevant. And it's exculpatory. The condition of that light when it pulled into the Sallyport driveway. And with regard to the inverted video, again, Mr. Brennan says there's nothing to see here. We've got inverted videos dating back days earlier. Then why, if that's such common knowledge, then why did Mr. Lally and Sergeant Butnick, in front of a jury, present that video as a true and correct presentation of what that car looked like and where that car was? Mr. Lally actually asked the question. I don't have a page in sight number, but I remember it because I was sitting here. He asked the question, did you see Mr. Proctor? Something, I'm paraphrasing, something along the lines of, did either you or Trooper Proctor approach that right passenger taillight? And the answer was no. Because on the video that was being played, it looked like the right passenger taillight was the one closest to the jury. And of course, Trooper Proctor walked right around that and went over to the other taillight. Except when you reverse it, you realize that's the right taillight.
Is there a copy of the reverse, the one that you played, is that in the exhibits for today's motion?
No. The one that's been corrected?
Yes. I'd like a copy of that.
I don't think I have. Sure. We can get that for the court immediately. Also, he played a video of the grainy video, showing, hey, look, some of these cameras are just grainy in other particulars as well, at other times and places. Maybe. Or maybe not. What's interesting is the grainy video that we saw, if my memory serves me, and it's my memory, and it's being taxed at this point, but my memory is the chyron on that video, in other words, the running numbers, was at the bottom. Yet the video he just played is at the top. That's the exact same video. If it's apples and apples, oranges and oranges, why is that different? That's interesting. And with regard to Ms. Reed's actual statements in that interview that was played, or I'm sorry, it wasn't played, it was recited. She said, some of the red plastic is missing. Some of the red plastic is missing. In other words, a piece is missing. It's completely consistent with the condition of that taillight before it was at the Sallyport. With regard to the facts that were recited by Mr. Brennan at the very end, every one of those is unsubstantiated. How does he know all that information? Who has he been talking to? And why don't we know about it? If in furtherance of this motion, there was an interview done of Lieutenant Fanning that laid out all of this information about not having contact with jurors and not doing this and not doing that, but yes, doing this and that and the other thing, why is the first time I'm hearing about this when he stands up and tells us? That has been the pattern of this Commonwealth's presentation to this court and in front of the jury consistently. That is the punctuation mark at the end of the sentence. Why am I just now getting that? Why wasn't that appended to his motion? Was there a conversation Mr. Brennan had with Lieutenant Fanning that we need to know about? This is exactly why, Your Honor, exactly why. If this court is not inclined to dismiss this case, and it should, the maladies of the Brady concerning the Brady violations and the discovery violations are so manifold in this case
that I stood up in rebuttal and said that it was in court advocating for my client. He then said court TV is not a courtroom.
So before you go further,
yes.
I don't know if Mr. Brennan was going to give me a court TV site on that. Is
right.
there one, Mr. Brennan?
I'll have to provide a video. I think that Mr. Iannetti is referring to that comment that was a court comment. And so I intend on remedied that record. There was also a conversation after with court.
All right, so provide it to Mr. Iannetti. Mr. Iannetti, I'll give you an opportunity to respond once you get that. But go ahead, you can tell me what you want to tell me now.
Right now it's out in the court of public opinion that I made this extrajudicial statement. I said specifically I did not. He contradicted me, and that's where we left it, and he said that he would produce the receipts. Now he's admitting he does not have the receipts. There was no court TV interview where I said anything of the sort. That was a Zoom hearing, where I was arguing before Your Honor. I would just note, Your Honor, I don't think it makes sense that Mr. Brennan would have done this on purpose because it was so easily disprovable. But it's troubling that he would make this damaging accusation without properly vetting it to see if it is true before he attacks opposing counsel. So that was disappointing to me. And I would just point out, and I only need 30 seconds. That,
take your time, Mr. Iannetti. You're not going to be 35 minutes.
Right. I certainly will not be. This new false allegation comes after my colleague, Mr. Alessi, co-counsel Mr. Alessi, on February 25th, detailed 9 or 10 false statements that Mr. Brennan has made to this court. And I want to make it clear, I don't need an apology from Mr. Brennan. I don't expect one. But I think perhaps he should apologize to the court. He said today, a lie unchecked becomes the truth. And I just would hope, Your Honor, that you hold Mr. Brennan to the same standard that you hold the defense team. And that's it.
I certainly do. So, Mr. Brennan, if you do not have a site, then I need you to let us all know that as well.
I will. It's convenient to retort that there were 10 lies by the court that Mr. Alessi lined up. And in fact, I looked at the transcripts, some of his suggestions that I didn't read the paperwork properly, which is wrong. I didn't try to shame him today. It was part of advocacy, and I accept that. There was a conversation, and if you remember, when I related Mr. Iannetti's remarks, it wasn't in relation to 3.6. It was in relation to the fact that they were using the federal investigation to create innuendo that could not be responded to. But I will provide...
For your request for the gag order? In support of your argument for the gag order?
In response to how they had federal materials that were under seal that couldn't be rebutted to make suggestions. It directly related to that point, not 3.6. But I will provide the videos. Mr. Iannetti is right, and the exact statement that I used was from a court hearing, but then there were subsequent statements made. And so my regrets to Attorney Iannetti, but it wasn't in the fashion of a 3.6 violation. That wasn't the intention. It was to show how they've used these federal materials before the case was closed to their advantage.
All right. So if you have the site, I'll give you until tomorrow afternoon to find the court TV site.
Very well.
If you have it, supply it to Mr. Iannetti. So I'm ordering the Commonwealth, if they have that court TV site, to provide it to all of us. And if you don't, provide that as well. Provide
very
that information.
Thank
well.
You.
Thank you. All right. That's it for today.
All right. Support, please.
You are muted.
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.